You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
A.S. Byatt won the Booker Prize in 1990 for her novel Possession, and her latest, the children's book, was shortlisted for the prize. It's a sprawling saga chronicling the lives of a noted children's book author, her family, and friends, and despite its title, the goings-on are not all G-rated. It's published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Dame Antonia back to our show today. Always a pleasure to see you.
And you.
The novel centers on Olive Wellwood, a children's book author who lives in Kent with her husband Humphrey, who's a journalist, at the end of the Victorian era. Is it significant that she writes books for children?
It is very significant because I think it was a period in which everybody was interested in children and in which, you know, literary critics were saying the greatest writing of our time appears to be written for children and also read by adults. And I think it was the two things, really. Children were suddenly being liberated from being seen and not heard. And great children's literature was indubitably being written.
Well, Lewis Carroll at the beginning of this book, right? And Edward Lear.
And then you go on to Rudyard Kipling, Edith Nesbit, all the Andrew Lang collections of fairy books which came in on the back of that. And at the centre of many of the things in my novel is the terrifying Peter Pan, the boy who wouldn't grow up.
Well, there also were some pretty great writers working for adults at the time. But I guess the perception was that something new had happened.
Yes, or something not quite new, because I think they were wanting to hang on to their childhood, like Kenneth Graham, who wrote The Wind in the Willows, long past the moment when that childhood should have been over.
Same with Lewis Carroll, to some degree, his interest in young people.
Yes, indeed, yes, indeed.
Go into that any further. You have written about fairy tales and other things. Have you ever written children's book?
No, I haven't, though this novel contains the only fairy story I ever attempted to write for one of my grandchildren, and at that time I didn't finish it. It's the story of the children in the house, the little girl who has a doll's house into which she puts some very small people she finds in the roots of a tree, and then a giant child comes and picks up her house and puts it in a house. I rather liked that idea.
So you gave it to your children's book writer, Olive?
Yes, I did, and my granddaughter has read the book and likes it no end, so she grew up in the interim.
But this is something you've done in the past as well, had someone else's writing within a book. Is it fun to find different voices and incorporate them in the same novel?
It's a wonderful feeling. I thought before I wrote Possession that I couldn't do it. I thought I had a voice. And then I got terribly bored of that voice. And also, I got bored of flat realism, the kind of novel that supposes that the way it tells you about the world is the only real way to tell you about the world. Because there are ways in which fairy stories tell you things that are more true and also more interesting.
You mentioned Edith Nesbit, and it's been said that this book was somewhat modeled on her, or that your character, Olive, was modeled on her.
Yes, I've been trying to avoid people making that identification. There are events in Olive's life which the fact, for instance, that all the children in the house turn out not to be the children of both the parents, which are exactly like the events in E. Nesbit's life. But E. Nesbit was a middle-class lady, always comfortably off. My Olive, in her childhood, is much more like D.H. Lawrence. And I think in her sort of nature, she has things in common, at least as much with D.H. Lawrence and various other people, as she does with Nesbit.
Well, she and her husband are Fabians. They are, which is a group that we usually associate with George Bernard Shaw. They live in a kind of loose-knit artist community, and it would lead to something that I guess we always associate with the 1960s, but was definitely happening around this time.
There was a programmatic belief in free love, and that went from the very hard line of the German anarchists, or indeed the American anarchists with Emma Goldman. They absolutely believed that people had free love and should do what they liked. And this led to all sorts of difficulties for all sorts of people. The Fabians also believed somehow that they should try out free love. And they were, of course, invaded by H.G. Wells, that terrifying person who seduced anything that came within his line of vision that he found at all attractive.
But they were also in favor of idealistic things, social justice, artistic expression, emancipation of women, things that might have been considered radical at the time.
Oh, absolutely. And they put forward programs to deal with the terrible problem of the poor and the unemployed and the old. They proposed things like old age pensions and social security and really tried to do something. They still are actually trying to do things. They exist.
But were they the precursors of the Labour Party?
They weren't members of the Labour Party. They talked about whether they would join it, and I think they weren't, partly because their name comes from a Roman general, Fabius Cunctator, who believed in proceeding gradually. And there were large chunks of the Labour Party that did sort of believe in revolution and overturning things. And so although they would work with them, they weren't part of them.
Olive meets her husband when he gives a lecture to the poor in London.
There was an enormous movement which is mocked by a socialist called Hindman. He said a lot of elegant ladies got into carriages and went out into this terrible desert of the East End. And when they had met a nice sort of socially minded young man they wanted to marry, they retreated into rich London and went on giving tea parties. But there was a lot of idealistic lecturing. The more I investigated it, the more moved I was. People were teaching working people the whole of the works of Shakespeare, the whole of history, how to think about politics. And it was being greedily absorbed by the audiences.
George Bernard Shaw and other real figures make appearances in the book. Would it have been possible to write about this literary world without bringing them in?
They're needed as markers. I think of them as tent pegs, in a way. They hold down, as it were, the ballooning canvas of my imaginary world into real places. Oscar Wilde appears at one point, and regarding him as a tent peg is a kind of insult.
My guest is A.S. Byatt, whose latest novel is the children's book, not intended for children, actually, published by Knopp. The story opens in 1895, ends in 1919. This is an era of great transition. Is that why you wanted to write about it?
Yes, it was also because I didn't know much about it. I knew a lot about the early Victorians who went into possession. 1859, when possession took place, is the year of the origin of species. And I didn't so much like the literature of this late Victorian period that went into the Edwardians. So I always avoided it till I got this idea about children's stories.
Well, I like George Gissing a lot, actually. But
My mother wrote a thesis on George Gissing in Cambridge in the 1920s. And she did, too.
This is a time when child-rearing practices were changed, along with the literature for children. Why was that? What was leading to this shift?
I haven't quite worked it out, but they certainly did change. There was a practice, which I discovered late in the writing of this book, of the adults trooping up to join the children at nursery tea and actually talk to them. And this in the middle classes, was in many ways a revolution. They did see children as people, and all these children who appear in books by writers like E. Nesbitt are real people with real characters.
Is this because of other changes that were taking place at the time, political changes, social changes?
I think it was.
Child labor laws were being
The children were
changed.
No longer working in the mines. I mean, Olive has siblings because she comes from South Yorkshire coalfield, who did work in the mines. She has a brother who was put to sit in the dark and open and shut a gate with a string for trolleys of coal coming through. And, of course, there had been huge social agitation on behalf of these children to get them out of the mines. I'm not quite sure what it was. There was a general burst of desire to educate everybody. In a way, the desire to educate the working class was the same thing as the desire to make children into real, rounded people. And it was all very good and exciting. And
But you said earlier that it was also a time when adults started reading children's books. I remember in the 60s, a woman I worked with told me that the only book she ever had to read was Alice in Wonderland, and she was kind of, she looked down upon me for reading all those other books. But you wrote an op-ed piece for the New York Times in 2003, which was a critique of the Harry Potter books and the adults who read them.
Well, I couldn't quite see why the adults were so addicted to Harry Potter. I can see why an adult might have picked up Harry Potter and said, yes, this is a very good children's book. But I can't quite see how they got addicted. I am addicted to Terry Pratchett, but I think he's a kind of philosopher.
Well, do you think that we go through phases where realism is the dominant style and then fantasy becomes a dominant style?
I think we do that.
I mean, right now, all the American popular culture is filled with vampires.
Yes, I'm reading a wonderful book which I've just started, and I've forgotten the name of the author. I think it's Grossman, about a young man who walks through a wall into a school for sorcerers, but I've only got to page 20. But it's looking pretty good, and it's a sort of a critique. It's based on everything from C.S. Lewis to Harry Potter. It's a partly sending them up and partly inhabiting them. I think it's partly simply that people's best reading experiences were when they were children. I used to teach in an art school in the 60s, and some of the students were extremely well read, and some had only read Tolkien. And they read Tolkien, and they read Tolkien, and they read Tolkien. And I had read Tolkien, so I could talk to them. And I said, you know, you might try Tolstoy. And some of them did. And some of them went on saying, no, my best reading experience was when I read The Hobbit when I was a child, and somehow nothing has meant anything much since then. That's partly the fault of people who teach literature in schools, that nothing has meant much since then.
The Wellwoods, Olive and Humphrey, believe in letting their children run wild in the woods, encourage them to express their creativity. It sounds like the sort of thing that A.S. Neal did later with Summerhill, but also with some of the things that we've heard from some education theorists more recently.
There aren't so many hills left in Britain for anyone to run wild in. I did go to see Beedale's school, which was founded around about this time. There were all these foundations of free-feeling schools. And I was very moved by it. All the children there used to be sent out to work in the garden, and they did all their own. I think they even cleaned out their own latrines, because the headmaster believed very strongly that they should live close to the earth, so they did. But at Beedale's, they still do. You know, if a child wants to found a cookery thing and make donuts and sell them to the other children, they're allowed to do that. I'm not sure any of my children have been, or grandchildren, are being brought up in quite that way.
You mentioned recommending Tolstoy, and that reminded me that this is not only a big book, but it has lots of characters, the kind of book that we associate with the great Russian writers or the English writers of the end of the 19th century.
Yes, this happened partly because there needed to be a lot of children and there needed to be a lot of characters in order to get in all the aspects of the things I was writing about. And I think I've always loved those very big novels, and I think I've got old enough now to control one when I'm writing it. Control sounds a horrible word.
No, but it's keeping track of a lot of different characters. In the Russian novels, at least in the English language versions, we often get a list of characters in the front so that we can keep track of them all.
Yes, people have asked me why I didn't put a list in front of this novel, and I possibly should have done, but I feel all the characters are recognizable, partly because I love them all so much. They're not incidental characters or characters who poke in. They all, about 12 of them, have very strong stories.
And you follow them from their childhood to adulthood.
Yes.
As their lives diverge and then come back together again.
Yes, I do. And I sort of both planned it out and followed them literally. I sort of felt what was happening to them, and some of them sort of make surprising turns. One of the young women, who appears to be much the most sensible one, suddenly does something completely out of character which ruins her life. And I was actually quite moved by them while I was writing them. I got very fond of them as a group of people. people are always asking you if you love your characters or miss them. And I say, no, no, characters aren't like that. Characters are in the book. You're out of the book. But I was also reading these characters like a person reading a children's book. You know, I cared what happened to them.
But you also mentioned that your character did something surprising. Did she surprise you when this happened?
She did a bit, yes.
You're writing the book, and you have this character, and you kind of know her, and then suddenly, obviously, I mean, you do it, but you're surprised by a thought, hey, maybe I'll have her do this instead of what you
might have
expected.
I think that was partly a function of having so many, because they were all going along like a sort of row of surfers on the crest of a wave, and suddenly you look left and you see, oh my goodness, that one has crashed at this moment. It didn't, for that reason, ruin the sort of onward movement of the whole book. It just meant that there was a chapter or two when she coped with the disastrous consequences of a momentary impulse.
S. Byatt is my guest, the Booker Prize-winning author of Possession. Her latest is the children's book, which is published by Knopf. It opens in the South Kensington Museum, which is now the Victoria and Albert Museum, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
It wouldn't have been called that then because Victoria and Albert were still at Buckingham Palace.
They were there. It was actually founded by Prince Albert, the South Kensington Museum, after the Crystal Palace Great Exhibition. He wanted to found, and this is a marvellous thing, he wanted to found a great museum where British craftsmen could see perfectly good and very varied examples of all the things they might want to be doing, from furniture to silverware to pottery to clothes. And he was a most far-seeing and wonderful man, and it was unfortunate that he died. She wanted to call it the Albert Museum when it finally got its name, the old Queen. And the government insisted it be called the Victoria and Albert Museum.
And was this innovative at the time? I mean, it obviously celebrates an aspect of British life that some other cultures can not be as proud of. The British have Wedgwood and so many other things.
It was also going on very strongly in Germany. The Germans were founding museums of exactly the same.
And Albert was German.
Yes, he was. And they were having. And then in the novel, I described the great Universal Exhibition in Paris in 1900, which was the most wonderful thing. Every country in the world built a palace along the river Seine in Paris, and they all brought examples of all the wonderful things they made, and the Chinese came and danced, and the Indians served tea, and the Ecuadorian palace was a sort of sugary crystal-looking thing, which was subsequently taken to Ecuador and turned into a post office in Guayaquil. And I was giving a reading the other day, and a man came up to me, and he said, I live next to that post office. And I was so moved.
Olive has gone to the museum to research magical objects to use in her stories, but instead winds up taking in a young runaway, Philip Warren, who has been living in the basement of the museum and sketching objects in the collection. Was taking in runaways something that the Fabians often did?
I think they did, and certainly people in children's book took in runaways. The opening of the book is a kind of classical example of the opening of a children's book in a way. There's the dirty boy, and they get him and they make him into a clean boy and they allow him to fulfill his dream of being a great potter. I think they did, and I don't know how well it always went. But
well, Philip grew up in the potteries, and although he aspires to become a potter, he's run away from there. Why? Because working in the factories was really brutal and not particularly artistic?
It was extremely brutal, and he was carrying what are known as saggers, which are sort of great big heavy trays of pots which were put in the huge tall kilns. And he'd seen good pots, and his mother was what was then known as a paintress, who painted very delicate things on delicate china. But he knew that you could actually make a pot yourself and it would be good. In a way, he was the character at the beginning about whom I most cared. My maternal family came from the potteries, and he has what I have, this desire to make something that is really good.
Well, because your family came from the potteries, is that how you were able to provide so much detailed technical information on ceramics?
Partly that, but not really. Really, it was because my eldest daughter lives next door to a person who must be one of the greatest living artists in ceramics, Edmund Duval, who has just made the most wonderful new installation in the Victoria and Albert ceramics thing, a sort of huge thing in the dome with a red lacquer tray full of 580-something wonderful pieces of porcelain. But he invited me to his studio and told me the history of pottery and allowed me to put my hands inside a pot on his wheel.
You mentioned that Philip was the first character you were fond of. Did your allegiances shift as you went from character to character?
Well, I think the two I was fond of at first were Philip, who was obsessed with one thing, and Olive's daughter, Dorothy, who is also obsessed with one thing. She announces at a summer party, when asked what she's going to do, that she's going to be a doctor. And she'd never thought of that before she said it. But then she saw she was a doctor. And I like people who are single-minded and want to... But then I found I was getting just as attached to all the other characters. There's Dorothy's cousin, who gets to be known as Charles Carl because he's English and German. And he is the son of a banker, but he decides that it is his duty to become an anarchist. And I got very fond of him and the movements of his mind as a rich young man who knew he should be an anarchist. And then I got fond of his sister, Griselda, who didn't like being put in beautiful clothes but didn't quite know what she did want. And then I got, as each one had their section and I wrote it, it was as though they were the central character.
You've noted that several children of children's book authors committed suicide. Why do you think that is?
The theory I had when I began was that the children's book authors wanted themselves to stay in their own childhood. So there was actually no room for a real child in these imaginary childhood worlds. And I think this was certainly true of Crenneth Graham, who wrote The Wind in the Willows. E. Nesbitt, I think, had moments of grown-upness. But she had a resident friend and helper who looked after her children, really, while she got on with the writing. And I'm not sure she was writing for her own children. I think she was writing for the child she would have liked to be.
This book has been highly praised and was shortlisted for the Booker. I guess it's now the Booker Man. How important are those accolades at this point in your career?
Very important, I think. When I was young, I assumed I wouldn't go very far and nobody would care very much and I had to keep writing. Now, oddly, it moves me much more when somebody writes a really good review and really seems to like the book. And I was pleased to have got on the Booker shortlist. It meant a great deal.
And then some of them have been made into films, although I'm sure you're a bit more ambivalent about that. Authors are never completely happy with the film adaptations of their work.
May I say that with Philip Haas's adaptation of Angels and Insects, I was completely happy. And one of the really good things about going on book tours is that somebody in the audience will always say, I hope you know that Philip Haas's film was a masterpiece. And so I say, yes, yes, I do, because it really was a film of what I wrote, and it really was an original film. And everybody was perfectly cast. There wasn't one actor whose performance made me cringe. They were acting the people in my book, and this must be almost unique, I would have thought, among writers and films.
Are you working on another novel?
I have one in my head which has half a character at the moment. It's about surrealists, and it only has half a character, but I've been doing a lot of preliminary reading around. I've just finished The Life of Peggy Guggenheim, which I enjoyed immensely.
So that gets you inspired, reading about somebody like some of these writers, the children's book writers of this era, get you thinking about how you might want to deal with that material?
With the surrealists.
Well, in this case, the surrealists.
Yeah. Yes, it does, and I like to know quite a lot before I have a plot or characters, and then the plot or the characters do actually grow out of the world of the novel and grow in the world of the novel. Some people, I think, invent modern people and put them into the world they've decided to put them in. I like to watch the world make the people.
My guest has been A.S. Byatt, whose latest novel is The Children's Book, which was shortlisted for the book of this year, a year in which there were any number of wonderful books. You can't feel bad if you lose to a book that is also quite fabulous.
Well, I had been going around telling everybody to read Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall, and indeed I had even bought a copy of it for my reading granddaughter, to whom I gave my own book. And no, and also she has not been, I think, as well recognized as she should have been, because she is so ambitious. She writes different kinds of books all the time. One Hilary Mantel does not resemble another, and this makes it hard for people to pigeonhole her. And now I think it's wonderful, you know, that she has won the Booker. Of course, I should have liked to do so myself. Anybody would.
A.S. Byatt's The Children's Book is published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Well, thank you.